ago, and Canadian doctors have called for this in a concerted way over the past few years.
Dr. Tariq Lubani, want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian-Canadian doctor, emergency room physician based in London, Ontario, Canada. We'll link to your piece in the Washington Post on what's happening in Gaza. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. By the way, if you want to get our daily quarantine report, Democracy Now!'s daily show and all its reports and transcript, video and audio podcast form, you can send the word Democracy Now! One word to 66866. Text the word Democracy Now! One word to 66866 or sign up online at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriano Contreras, Maria Tarasane, our general managers, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Dennis Moynihan, I'm Amy.
KBOO supporters, this is Kat Miao, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our annual spring membership drive. Canceling such an important fundraiser was not an easy choice, but thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed now through May 31st will be matched up to $20,000. We know that times are tough right now, so we're asking those of you who are able to give to donate today at kboo.fm/give. Financial support from our listeners is what allows community radio to carry out the important role we play in times like these. Give today at our website. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Thanks for your support and thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
You're listening to Popular Education Radio here on 90.7 on your FM dial. My name is Tammy, and today I have the delight and privilege of airing my interview with Richard Silverstein of Tikkun Olam. Tikkun Olam is one of the earliest progressive Jewish blogs, been on the web since February of 2003, and it focuses on the Israeli national security state. On this episode of Popular Education Radio, I'll be speaking with Richard about the global repercussion that the COVID-19 pandemic has had on both Palestine and Israel, and we'll also be discussing his recent article published in the Jacobian magazine titled Israel is Militarizing and Monetizing the COVID-19 Pandemic. A full version of this interview is available wherever it is you get your podcasts. Just search for Popular Education Radio. If you'd like to reach out to me to get some more information about the subject, you can email me at populareducationradio@gmail.com or reach out to me on the social media, Popular Education Radio on Instagram. To educate more listeners about the current situation following the COVID-19 pandemic in Palestine and Israel, KBOO Community Radio is sponsoring an online webinar to talk about the subject. For more information, go to kboo.fm/kboo webinar. And also, stay tuned to the middle of this interview to get some more information about some of the speakers that will be attending. Again, that's kboo.fm/kboo webinar. Now, without further ado, here's my interview with Richard Silverstein. Thank you.
Well, I write the blog Tikkun Olam, which I've been doing since 2003, and it focuses on Israel and national security issues, and Israel as a national security state. And I focus in particular on breaking news that is either under censorship or under judicial gag order, because there's a great deal of capacity in Israel and a desire to suppress secret information that they don't want either the Israeli public or the outside world to know about. Examples might be reporting on Israeli arms sales to repressive regimes around the world, or reporting on Israel's nuclear weapons program, or reporting on issues of sexual abuse and gender discrimination in Israel, and also reporting on the misdeeds and war crimes of the Israeli army. So I serve as sort of a safety valve for Israel, because sometimes its media can't report on these very critical issues. And because I am located outside of Israel, I'm not under the same sort of strictures or jurisdiction as Israeli media. So I'm freer to report on these important issues.
And so do you find that your readers are also people in Israel as well as Americans?
Yes, it's quite a large following in Israel, including anyone from an average citizen who wants to learn about what can't be reported in the Israeli media to actual Israeli policymakers, intelligence folks, and military folks, and think tank people and academics that are looking for more specialized information. And there's a fairly good-sized audience outside of Israel, activists, human rights lawyers, academics, people who need this sort of information for whatever they do professionally, people in Washington and things like that.
Moving forward to more recent, obviously the global situation that everyone is facing and how that intersects with the militarization of Israel's forces within Israel, also the surrounding territories. Of course, there's a huge Palestinian population that is very much affected by every, whether it's a policy change or, this type of global pandemic that Israel is basically responsible to pretty much take care of the people in the surrounding areas. Now, is that correct, or am I getting that kind of wrong?
No, absolutely. Israel occupies the West Bank and Gaza. Even though it doesn't have forces in Gaza, it's still technically and under international law, it's responsible for what happens in Israel, since it's in Gaza, because it's under blockade. So Israel also, in addition to Gaza and the West Bank, Israel has a million Israeli-Palestinian citizens, and all of them face different levels of deprivation, not just economic or social, but also health deficits compared to Israeli Jewish citizens. So, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian community inside Israel, until very recently, the government provided no testing for Israeli-Palestinians, and there were significant outbreaks of COVID-19 in those communities, and they were basically left to their own devices. Some of them had small hospitals, but the hospitals don't generally have the specialized equipment that are needed, the ventilators and the sort of sophisticated equipment needed for severe cases that hospitals catering to the Jewish population have. And in the West Bank and Gaza, it's even worse because they're outside of Israeli borders, and Israel has even less concern for those people, and they're even more under the gun. Luckily, while there have been outbreaks, for example, Gaza, which is, I mentioned, under blockade, and so it is fairly isolated, and while there have been some episodes of COVID-19, it hasn't been as severe as it might have been. But these are really dangerous situations for the Palestinians, because Israel has basically, as I mentioned, left them to their own devices. And you also have conditions there where people are even poorer than in Israel and have less resources and live in much more cramped quarters and live in refugee camps, and those are breeding grounds for COVID-19. So it's very possible that there could be a huge outbreak in the Palestinian communities. And if I can go to talk about Israel itself, there are also there's another population in Israel that is very susceptible to COVID-19. And for different reasons, it has disregarded a lot of the regulations that the government's put in place, and that is the ultra-Orthodox community of Jews who are extremely religious and live a segregated life inside Israel in which they have cut themselves off from the secular society and secular government, and they kind of live inside their own communities, and they have their own sort of rabbinic authorities that they pay attention to, and those people have ignored a lot of the regulations for distancing and for quarantine, and there have been huge outbreaks in some of these communities, one called Bnei Brak, one of the largest cities in for ultra-Orthodox in Israel. And the government has had to, in some cases, go in there and arrest people and throw them in prison. And it's had to really come down hard on some of the rabbinic authorities that were telling people that they could pray together, which is another place where you can spread this illness. And they were having weddings, you know, with 100, 150 guests where this was also happening. So in some cases, authorities have said that up to 30 or 40% of all cases in Israel are in the ultra-Orthodox community. So you have those two very vulnerable communities in Israel, and the government is not doing a very effective job with either one of them.
Now, were there any numbers that showed that the Palestinian population responded differently as opposed to the ultra-Orthodox population? And a follow-up to that would be, do you think that it's out of distrust for the government, or more of like where does that stem from?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's two different situations that are somewhat linked. One is that because the Israeli Palestinians, and certainly the Palestinians themselves, are mistreated or treated as second-class citizens, I'm talking now about the Israeli Palestinians, there's a great level of distrust. Basically, the Israeli Jewish authorities, government officials, have let those communities fester, suffering benign neglect. They invest much less in those communities. They provide much lower level of services in those communities. So there is automatically a great level of mistrust there. And there was a case in Yafo, which is a Palestinian neighborhood near Tel Aviv, where the police arrested a Palestinian resident. And there were riots as a result, and there were stoning of firefighters who came in to put out what had been set by protesters. So they were ostensibly protesting against the arrest of this fellow, and he was arrested because he wasn't wearing a mask and not following government relations. It's really a case of the government not doing anything to integrate the Palestinians into Israeli society, or not doing a good job of it. And it's also a case of a low level of education, a low level of social awareness, maybe a low level of Palestinian sort of wanting to listen to what they might be hearing on the media about what policies they should be following. So, even though some of the interactions and reactions and protests might seem on the surface to be counterproductive and sort of going against rules that you would follow to protect yourself, a lot of it stems from the government's racism against these people. And a similar case with the ultra-Orthodox, although there it's because they're themselves off from society and don't treat the official secular authorities as figures that are to be obeyed. They pay attention to their rabbis, and their rabbis told them most of this period that we're in that they could go about their business and didn't have to social distance and didn't have to quarantine themselves. And they said, if you're praying, then you're doing God's work, and God will protect you and things like that. And there's been a case also of a rabbi who has a charity, and the charity for $750 will guarantee, that's in scare quotes, that you and your family don't get COVID-19. So the ultra-Orthodox are anti-science, and they're anti-public health. And, you know, part of this it's not just that they are to blame for their own attitudes. The government and society of Israel is to blame because it has allowed this sort of segregation to happen. And there are benefits to society politically because the ultra-Orthodox have their own political parties, and those political parties use their power to get into governing coalitions where they are given benefits and perquisites that other communities in Israel aren't given. So, for example, the health minister of Israel is an ultra-Orthodox rabbi. He is not someone who knows anything about public health or about science or about medicine, and he, in fact, violated his own ministry's regulations for quarantine, and he himself got COVID-19. But you have this situation where there's so much political power in these communities that the governing coalitions, in this case it's the Likud and the far right, need to put them into the coalition, and they have to do things like naming this guy as the health minister. And this has bled into the society and the government's ineptitude and dysfunction in terms of the way it's dealt with COVID-19. It's true that Israel has had, I think, about 12,000 cases of COVID-19, and it's had nearly 200 deaths, which, if you compare it to Italy, Iran, or the United States, it might be somewhat better. And maybe the response has been a little bit better than we've had under President Trump. But much more could have been done. And the elements of society that are the most damaged by COVID-19 are those underprivileged, discriminated against, and much like in the United States, where we have the minority communities, African American communities, that far outweigh the other communities in terms of the effect of the damage that this illness is inflicting.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the health minister, M.K. Is it Litzman, I think?
Litzman.
Litzman, yes. I don't know if the irony is lost that unfortunately they are sick with the COVID. That's one thing about Israel during this pandemic. At least when it started, they just finished their third election. Can you talk a little bit about what that looked like, having an election post, or I guess the election was during the COVID and the results came out, and then Netanyahu did not step down because they created the emergency government. Can you explain that a little bit? And also, is there any conversation of perhaps a fourth election?
Oh yeah, sure. So the election happened in March, I believe it was early March, and COVID-19 was just starting to sort of percolate in society. The first case, I think, of COVID-19 in Israel was in the middle of March, and I think the election was about a week earlier. So, but Israelis knew about COVID-19 because it had already hit China and other places, and they knew it was coming. And in the midst of all this, Netanyahu faced the most jeopardy that he's ever faced in his political career, because there were three corruption charges that he was indicted for by the Attorney General. And the cases haven't gone to court yet. There was a date set for April, and that was put off because the courts have been closed, essentially. And so Netanyahu is a fairly astute tactician, realized that he needed to pull out all the stops in order to save his career. So he saw COVID-19 as a way to show Israelis that he is the strong leader. Normally, he calls himself Mr. Security, and he approves his bona fides to the electorate by launching raids against Palestinians and bombing Gaza and talking tough about Iran and about Hezbollah. But now he saw an opportunity because COVID-19 sort of took the place of the Arab enemy, and it was COVID-19 that he could really show his strength to the electorate. And what he did was he revealed to Israel that there was a top secret database that the domestic intelligence agency called the Shin Bet was maintaining since 2001, just after the 9/11 attacks, that the Israeli government gave the Shin Bet the right to create a massive national database that incorporated every citizen, whether Jewish or Palestinian, and that would basically track every citizen, their geolocation. I guess they did this through their smartphones. It would track where they went, who they met, who they talked to. It would track their cell phone usage and text messages, emails, phone calls. And the Shin Bet would know who you talked to, what you said. And it was started out as a database that was designed to counter terror threats. But what Netanyahu told people after reviewing this secret document database was that we are now going to use this for COVID-19. He needed to get the permission of the Knesset to do that, but he didn't get it because of this emergency government situation you mentioned. And he just summarily made a ruling, an executive ruling, that this database was now approved for usage. So the Shin Bet is now identifying people who've had COVID-19. It's using that to warn people who came into physical contact with anybody who had the illness, to put them into quarantine. And anyone who refuses to follow the directives can be fined $1,500 and put in prison for 6 months. So the effect that this has is it transforms a public health crisis into a security crisis. And that is very, very characteristic of Israel, because it sees every issue not like most democracies might see them. For example, in the case of COVID-19, we have our health authorities that are addressing the issues. We have the hospitals, and we have FEMA, and we have CDC, who are going out and purchasing the equipment that health authorities and doctors and nurses need to treat patients. In Israel, a lot of this authority has been ceded to the security services because, as I mentioned, the health ministry is so inept for the reasons I mentioned. So you have the Mossad bragging to Israelis that they brought in the first shipment of medical gear was brought in from a secret location, which I think has been reported as United Arab Emirates, which is a state that has a tacit alliance with Israel for reasons we probably won't go into right now. But and Mossad officials bragged on a television magazine show, that was the most popular show in Israel, that they stole the equipment. They didn't pay for it; they stole it. And since then, the Mossad has been bringing in other shipments from similar locations, and now they're no longer saying they're stealing them. Presumably, they're paying for them. But this is a characteristic of Israel, where Ronan Bergman, who is an Israeli reporter who now contributes to the New York Times, he wrote a glowing article in the Times about the heroic efforts of the Mossad to help the Israeli population. And there was absolutely no recognition of the fact that this is an anomaly. This is not the way a democratic society should work. A public health crisis is exactly that. It needs to be dealt with by civilian authorities, by health authorities, by medical experts, and not by secret agents going around the world into dark corners and ferreting out respirators and ventilators and things like that. And this is the problem, that Israel doesn't see any issue as anything but one that can be dealt with by intelligence, by spying, by hacking, by military, in military terms.
Now, do you think that people in the Shin Bet, like stepping in and creating something like a GPS locator type of spying device, like because the health department just can't? Or I did hear there was some sort of a health department app. How would that differ than the GPS locator?
There was an app that the government was trying to promote in the Palestinian community, and if you downloaded it, it was pretty invasive, and the Palestinians were very suspicious of the app. I didn't hear that this app was being promoted in the Jewish community, but it's possible that it was. But to answer your question, I think that it's important to use technology as a tool to help you to track people who have COVID-19. I think it's useful also in identifying people who might have come into contact with a COVID-19 victim in terms of, you know, informing them of that information. But the vast mass surveillance characteristics of this database, which I haven't mentioned yet, but it's called, in Hebrew, it's called the tool, the database. The mass, and keep in mind, this was not initiated or created to deal with public health crisis. It was created to deal with terrorism. So if you're thinking about how the NSA operates or how the CIA operates, they want to know everything about every terror suspect that they can find out. And they want to intrude into someone's life to the most granular level to help them figure out what a suspected terrorist might do, or who they might meet, or who they might talk to. Now they're transferring this exact same type of technology to use in a public health crisis. So you're going to, of course, use the same terms in the public health crisis that you're using in a counterterror operation. And you're going to know far more about these people than you need to know. And so I have no problem with technology that's used within limits, that you cut off the level of data and granularity when you don't need it to address the public health crisis. But that's not what's happening here, because the Shin Bet is not adapting the database or restricting it. It's being used exactly the same way it would use to ferret out a terrorist. And the other thing that's important to note here is that there are many, you know, Israel has this reputation of being the startup nation and being sort of at the cutting edge of technology, and that can cut both ways. It can produce very helpful, advanced technology that's beneficial to society, helps in over health issues, and helps in all sorts of ways, but it can also be very damaging. And you have a company, one called NSO Group, which is now well known because it's being sued by WhatsApp for creating a hack that that intercepted the conversations that up to 1,400 users of WhatsApp were having. These people were being targeted by the clients of NSO Group, using the technology to hack into these conversations because repressive governments in the Middle East wanted to know what dissidents were saying, what human rights lawyers were saying, what journalists were saying. NSO Group is the leading cyber intelligence, cybersecurity company in the world, with its valuation is well over $1 billion. And until now, what it's been doing is selling malware that will infect cell phones and then turn the cell phone into a sort of monitoring device where you can track where a person goes, if they're a suspect, what they do, who they talk to, the same kind of terms I've mentioned. But these Gulf state countries and other intelligence agencies are using them to track the kinds of innocent civilians that I've mentioned. NSO Group has announced, and the defense minister of Israel has announced, that it's creating a civilian version of the tool, that the database I mentioned, and selling it to foreign governments. So the problem is going to be when these foreign customers start using the tool in a civilian context, they're going to be getting a product that was initiated to be incredibly intrusive and be a mass surveillance product. And they're going to be absorbing into their own societies the premises that the Israelis used to create it. In other words, Israel is a national security state. It's a garrison state. It's a mass surveillance state. So even if a country buying NSO's product has protections for individual citizens, the level of intrusion into private matters, private data of individual citizens is going to flood any protections that are in place in society, because the tools that NSO Group has created are so incredibly powerful. They're the most powerful on the market. There are other competitors out there in other countries, but NSO is par excellence in terms of, you know, what it's done here. And so the fact is that the culture of Israel, the militarization of Israel, is going to seep into Western democracies if they buy these products. And that's one of the things that concerns me the most, because there's no international regulation of cyber hacking, of cyber warfare technology like the kinds that NSO creates. So you don't have any limits placed on people. And NSO Group will tell you that our technology is only used for combating gang warfare and terror operations and drug dealing networks. But the fact is that once they sell a product to an intelligence agency, and they've done it to at least 40 countries, they proudly say, we don't have any control over what our customers do. We don't want any control over what our customers are doing. And that's part of the problem. So another country, police agency, whatever, can use these in any way that it chooses without any controls. And that is a really serious international problem.
It's like using the free market, or using the lack of rules in order to destroy people's lives. And so the opposition group, Blue and White, pretty much they dissolved. And Gantz, who was the head of that group, the opposition group to Bibi, is now the head of the Knesset speaker. So if pretty much the opposition to Bibi is now on Bibi's team, who is going to be able to create some sort of checks and balances? And what are the people's response to this type of cyber warfare that's basically being perpetrated on them?
Well, the problem is that Israeli society, you know, from when you're a young child until, you know, adulthood, it really is a security state. So, it boasts that it's a democracy, but it's a democracy in very kind of emasculated ways, because the common protections that a citizen might have in a Western democracy, many of them are non-existent. There's no constitution. There's no Bill of Rights. There is a civil society. There aren't NGOs that are protecting individual liberties and civil rights, but they are viewed with great skepticism, if not hostility, by the far-right government. And in fact, they're hounded and persecuted and harassed by the authorities often, and demonstrations by people that are trying to uphold civil liberties and uphold, trying to oppose war and do the things you're mentioning are pretty much, you know, they're dealt with through violence. The police are very hostile to them. So you have a thin layer of NGOs and activists that are doing good things, but they're really pretty much overwhelmed. And so the average citizen really is not questioning any of these uses. In fact, they're quite proud of the Startup Nation and Brand Israel and exporting these products to the world. And that's one of the reasons my role, I think, you know, a little bit prejudiced here, but I think my role is important because I take a sort of a magnifying glass and point out these inadequacies, point out the contradictions and the hypocrisies, so that there will be somebody looking from the outside in and trying to point out where Israel is falling short of, you know, the protections that might exist in other countries. I think we should also talk a little bit about politics, which you mentioned earlier, and the government and the elections and the unity government, which you started to get into. What happened is that there was basically a tie, election tie, in that March election I mentioned. So the center-right bloc, which was called Blue and White, nominally did better than the Likud. So there's a far-right bloc in Israeli politics, and there's a center-right bloc, and those are the two most powerful groups. And so Gantz had promised that he would never go into a coalition with Netanyahu because he was under indictment, and he promptly violated that promise when he decided that he was going to form a unit of government. At that point, his blue and white coalition split in half, and roughly about half of the blue and white went to follow Gantz attempting to create a unity government, and the other half, about 15 seats, 15 votes, stayed out of that and split off. So now you've had Netanyahu and Gantz trying to negotiate a unity government, and there have been all sorts of rumors and statements put out by both sides that were nearing agreement, but they never did achieve agreement, and a deadline came for them to do so, and they failed. So right now we're in this odd transition phase where for 21 days the Knesset itself can name a prime minister. So if any member of the Knesset can get together 61 people, members of Knesset, to vote for him or her to be prime minister, that person can become prime minister. So it's likely that that won't happen. I don't think it's ever happened before in Israeli history. But it does allow Netanyahu and Gantz to continue to negotiate. So they could conceivably come up with some plan. The reason why the unity government failed was because the Likud had given in to Gantz about judicial appointments and was going to allow Gantz to have an important role in making judicial appointments, and then they reneged on that, and that's why Gantz walked. Gantz is now, as you mentioned, the Speaker of the Knesset, so that means he controls the legislative agenda, and he can put forward a bill that will prohibit Netanyahu from ever becoming prime minister, because the bill will say that no indicted prime minister can serve in that role. So if he does that, then Netanyahu is finished. So Gantz is using that as a sword over Netanyahu's head to say, if you don't agree to a unity government, then my capacity as Speaker of the Knesset, I will pass this law and your career is done. So really, this is a game of chicken that's being played here. It's a very complicated game of chicken. And if at the end of that 21-day period that I mentioned, the Knesset doesn't find a prime minister, then we go to a fourth election. And what's complicated about that is, of course, this has never happened before. There has never been a situation where there were three elections within a year, and now we are threatening a fourth election within a year. But the polls are saying that because Netanyahu has such a good reputation dealing with COVID-19, which I mentioned earlier, he's seen now as in a stronger position if there were to be an election than this center-right bloc that I mentioned. So for Gantz, it's very dangerous waters that he's navigating as well. So it's an incredibly complicated, disruptive, and dysfunctional time for Israel. It's really almost a miracle that Israel hasn't had a massive contagion and pandemic going on in Israel, given how weak and disjointed the political process is. I mean, they're really in luck in terms of how they weathered this, because it could have been far, far worse. I mean, if you had a situation in Israel like you did in Italy or Iran, where, you know, the health system almost collapsed and society was, you know, just completely shattered by COVID-19, I just don't know what would have happened in Israel. It would have been a disaster.
You're listening to Popular Education Radio. I'm your host, Tammy. This is my interview with Richard Silverstein from Tikkun Olam, a progressive Jewish blog which focuses on the Israeli national security state and much more. For more information, go to richardsilverstein.com. If you're interested in how COVID-19 is affecting people in both Palestine and Israel, join us for a KABU webinar on Friday, May 1st at 11 a.m. to hear from guest speaker Dr. Osama Tenos as well as Richard Silverstein. For more information, go to kboo.fm/KABU webinar. Remember, you must register online to join this webinar. Again, that's kboo.fm/KABU webinar. For additional information, please contact publicaffairs@kboo.org. Now back to the interview.
Now, in Israel also, it has universal health care, right?
Yes.
And how does having universal health care play out during a pandemic like this one?
Well, if you were an Israeli Jew, you're doing fairly well, because you do have this public health care system that's quite good. And, you know, and so far, the people who have died in Israel have been the elderly, have been people with severely compromised in various ways. You know, some Holocaust survivors who survived the Holocaust, unfortunately, you know, succumbed to COVID-19. I haven't heard that much about people who are younger succumbing like you do here on the news here in the United States. So the public health system is excellent when it comes to how it treats Jews. And as I said, there is barely a public health system in the Israeli-Palestinian neighborhoods and communities. So those people are faring much worse. And I should mention something I haven't said so far. Another way in which the government has militarized the response to COVID-19 is it has totally shut down certain communities where, you know, they've put checkpoints at the entrances and exits of Israeli-Palestinian communities where there's been an outbreak of COVID-19, and they completely shut down the community I mentioned earlier, B'nai Brak. You could not go in and out of those communities. The Home Command, which is a branch of the Israeli army, was importing food into these communities so that the people could eat. And I suppose they were letting medical people in to the communities. But this is really quite unprecedented. In addition, they have the Israeli army patrolling civilian areas, Jewish communities. They've never done that before. Of course, the Israeli army and the Israeli police are always patrolling Palestinian communities and the patrolling in the occupied territories. That was sort of standard pro forma kind of behavior, but never before have they had the army patrolling, armed soldiers patrolling in Jewish communities. So it really has the effect of wearing down any democratic protections for civil rights that had existed, were even more worn down than they were before. You know, a lot of media articles have written about this in, you know, what's going on in other countries, but they're not paying quite as much attention to Israel. And I see Israel as really a laboratory for these kinds of developments. And that's why the Jacobin article that I wrote, I was hoping was going to get, you know, more play so that people in Western democracies were going to, you know, start to realize that Israel was going to be exporting all of this, all of these attitudes and products to them, and what the what the repercussions would be of the export of all of these sort of anti-democratic ideas outside of Israel.
So right now there is a leader who is facing indictment, a health minister who went against his own ministry, but also is now unfortunately sick with the virus itself. Like you said, it sounds like a political mess and a nightmare. And so let's, looking forward, if there is a fourth election, what do you think that would look like as far as people that will be throwing their hat in the ring? I know that Yair Lapid is also a person that you mentioned in the article, but also the joint list. Where's their place in the fourth election if there'll be one?
Well, the joint list, because it represents a very strongly identified political agenda, is doing well. Any party that sort of watered down its agenda, its platform, in order to create a coalition with a different party that had slightly milder or softer positions did fairly poorly. So you have the Israeli Zionist Left, which is, the party is called Meretz. They went into coalition with what was left of the Israeli Labor Party, which used to be a center-left party but has gradually drifted off to the right and even gone into this unity government under Benny Gantz and Netanyahu. So in the next election, if there is one, there probably won't be a Labor Party. So you have a party that's existed since the foundation of the state and been the sort of center-left identity in Israeli politics is really evaporated as part of a shift to the far right in Israeli politics. So you do have, as I mentioned, the split off of blue and white by parties that are led by Yair Lapid and by Moshe Bogi Yaalon, who's a former chief of staff. And so those parties will be in the next election. And I think that Gantz will do very badly in the next election because he betrayed the promise about not going into a coalition with Netanyahu. I think he's discredited himself. To be forthright, there are people in Israel who wanted a unity government very dearly because they thought that would be the way to unite the country to face COVID-19. But whenever there have been unity governments in the past, the parties that are on the center or on the left that go into those coalitions are trounced in the next election because a voter who's on the left who sees their party go into coalition with a far-right government is really becomes dissatisfied, and those parties do very badly, and that's how Labor basically destroyed itself. So parties like the Joint List, which are Israeli-Palestinian parties with some Jews who are allied with the left, do very well, and they scored the highest turnout and the highest number of seats in the Knesset that they had ever gained in the last third election that I mentioned. And the fourth election, they'll do as well or better. But 15 seats doesn't make a government. You need 61. So what was hopeful before Gantz decided to form a unity government, there was a chance that there could be a minority government in which the centrist bloc would govern with the support of the Palestinian parties. That was extremely controversial because Israel hasn't, since the 1970s, had a coalition government which existed with the support of Palestinian parties. And because of the racism inherent in Israeli society among Israeli Jews, they tend to view Palestinians, even though they're citizens of the state, as a fifth column or as suspect because they see them allied with Palestinians in the occupied territories. So there was a lot of controversy about that, and that's one of the reasons why Gantz gave up that idea. But while he was entertaining it, it was extremely hopeful because it had never been done before. And so there were many liberal Zionists and sort of people who consider themselves to be sort of a liberal humanist types or Democrats maybe in the U.S. terms were very hopeful and thought that this meant that the level of discrimination and racism in Israel was going to be reduced with the possibility that a Palestinian party would actually play a decisive role in government. It would have meant that the leaders of the Palestinian parties would have chaired Knesset committees, serious, powerful Knesset committees, and that would have been a first as well. It really is a shame that Gantz deserted that idea and went in for the unity government, because it would have made history in Israel, and it would have shown that Israel, as a society, there was hope that Palestinians could be integrated into the political system, could be given power, could be shared with them on an equal footing, and unfortunately that evaporated. So going into the next election, we're going to have the Israeli Zionist left probably on its own, and it will do much better, but it will only probably get 5 seats. So you'll have the joint list with probably 15 seats. The key question here is what happens in the center or in the kind of moderate right wing. What happens to the split off of the blue and white, and whether they do well or not? It's really an open question. I mean, we could have a government led by a prime minister who is not only indicted but convicted. It's never happened before. Now, if that happens, what will happen is the case will go to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court will be able to decide, can a prime minister who is indicted or a prime minister who is convicted serve as prime minister? There's a very strong possibility, even though the Supreme Court is fairly right-wing Supreme Court, it's not quite as right-wing as our current one, it might tell Netanyahu, you can't serve. And then his career is over as well. And that really opens up things for someone else in the Likud to take over. And you have a sort of a younger cohort in Likud that Netanyahu has tried to sweep aside. He sees any rival inside his own coalition as someone to destroy, because he doesn't want any rivals. But one of those people that he's tried to sweep it off to the side might come forward, and so you might have a new leader of the Likud. But the more you change these deck chairs on the Titanic, you know, it doesn't really mean you're going to have any change, significant changes in policy. It doesn't mean you're going to have someone who wants to negotiate peace with the Palestinians. It doesn't mean you're going to have someone who's going to oppose Trump's deal of the century, you know, which was you know, Jared Kushner's kind of miracle deal. It doesn't mean that you're going to have a centrist politician take over the country. It really basically means you're going to put a new face on the leadership, and you're going to have policies that are very similar to the ones that are in existence right now.
How's the economy in Israel right now, and also in the surrounding territories?
The Israeli economy has been going like gangbusters. It's a very kind of anomalous situation that even though the country is you know, has so many flaws in the way it's governed and social attitudes and things like that, and even though it mistreats you know, a significant minority of its population in ways that I talked about, the economy has been going like gangbusters. You know, the exports of military equipment, hardware, technology to the world is, you know, those exports are really desired, and those products are really desired by other countries. Israel is among the top 10 countries in exporting military weapons to the world. And some countries like India, it's the top exporter to India of all countries in the world. So, and you have this startup culture that I mentioned. So in terms of innovation and technology, Israel is often on the cutting edge. And so you have a huge sort of a Silicon Valley kind of effect in Israel, where probably an even larger portion of the economy is based on technology and exports and things like that. So the economy has been doing pretty well. However, as a caveat, I should mention that there is a whole set of really unskilled workers, not well-educated workers. They tend to be largely the Palestinians or the ultra-Orthodox, and there's a huge pockets of poverty in Israel. I mean, one in three children in Israel is living in poverty, and that's because the families that are producing the most children tend to be Palestinian or ultra-Orthodox, and they tend to be kind of shut out of the economy. So you have this great division of wealth in Israeli society, and there's a ranking done of OECD countries. Those are countries that are sort of considered Western democracies, and they measure social indices every year. And Israel, in terms of the division of wealth, is fifth out of 32 countries in terms of the severity of that gap. So you really have a kind of a majority that are doing extremely well economically, and then you have this very significant minority that really is shut out of all of those benefits, which is really a tragedy and partly brought on by what we've been talking about, this militarization and securitization of society, where they have done very little to try to integrate these pockets of poverty into society and try to make sure that these people receive the kind of education that they need and skills that they need to hold the kind of jobs that are producing such benefits for the segments of society that I mentioned.
And is there any conversation of opening up the economy? Or
yes, they are talking about opening up the economy. I think the date was somewhere in the within the next 2 weeks, maybe May 1st, I think, was the date that they were throwing around, because Israel hasn't had the kind of massive shock that we have had in Iran and Italy and some of these other countries. They're feeling more confident than we are about reopening the country. So, and I think that their level of cases is it has reached its peak. So I think they're considering that the worst is over. Not that it's not continuing, but that they're going to be coming onto the downside rather than continuing to climb up the hill in terms of how many cases they're seeing. So I think they're looking at May 1st, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it really does amplify the kind of independent, journalistic work that you do over in Tikkun Olam. And I really appreciate that you share all of this knowledge. And if you could just tell the listeners how they can read more about, the situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories.
Sure. First of all, I'd like to recommend that they take a look at that Jacobin article that I wrote on the militarization and monetization of COVID-19. It came out on April 16th. It's on the JacobinMag.org website. And my own blog is called Tikkun Olam, and the URL is richardsilverstein.com. And I welcome people to follow what I'm writing about and covering issues that relate to Israeli national security and also Israel's relationship with the world and U.S. foreign policy as it, deals with Israel and the Middle East and Israel's relationship with Iran and all those very interesting and complicated issues.
Thank you for listening to Popular Education Radio here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. My name is Tammy. I'm the host of Popular Education Radio. And if you'd like to hear the rest of this interview, then you can go to wherever it is you get your podcasts, whether it's Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and type in Popular Education Radio. And the rest of this interview will be there. If you are interested in this subject and would like to learn more about the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's affecting people in Palestine and Israel, then go to kboo.fm/webinar to sign up for our webinar, which will be happening on Friday, May 1st at 11 a.m. Again, you must register to attend this event. More information can be found on kboo.fm/kbuwebinar. You can also email publicaffairs@kbu.org for more information. I'd like to remind listeners that our membership drive is not going to be happening this spring because of the coronavirus, but we still need your donation in order to keep this free community resource independent and free. You can go to kboo.fm/give to donate. Your donation will take us a long way, and together we can weather through any storm. If you'd like to reach me, the host of Popular Education Radio, you can email me at populareducationradio@gmail.com or check out our Instagram page, Popular Education Radio. Stay tuned to our FM dial because coming up next is another great KBOO program, One Land, Many Voices. Thank you all so much, and don't worry, Portland, we'll get through this together.
On today's episode, we'll be listening to an interview with Rashid Khalidi talk about Palestine and the case of settler colonialism.